a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us. I'm Kelsey Pritchard with the Governor's Office. And just a reminder for everyone on the phone to please mute your lines now by pressing star 6, and you can unmute by pressing pound 6. And just a reminder for everybody in the room to use the microphones at the table. And with that, I'll turn it over to Lieutenant Governor Matt Michaels.
Good morning, everybody.
Oh, we're not ready yet? Okay, 1 minute.
Thank you. We'll be with you in just a short minute after this break.
Look up on your MLE 1. It's the top left window on the right screen. Is that where you're seeing video up there? Okay.
It's the stash. No, the stash really sets off the grin.
Good.
I've been told that. Yesterday, everybody showed up to a briefing, and they were, you know, Aberdeen folks, and they were all wearing fake stashes in honor. Okay. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for you covering this and also those who are on the phone doing the same. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and also answer your questions. First of all, as we put out in our advisory, the governor is in Washington, D.C. as we speak at the National Governors Association meeting. He has that meeting every year at this time, and in addition to the meetings that he attends, and there are many of them, he always and critically analyzes his schedule so he can meet with other individual members of the United States government so that we can go ahead and advance our interests. This week, and actually, he's going to be meeting with the Secretary of the Air Force and the Deputy Secretary of the Air Force as well to talk about the facilities out at Ellsworth. And get to know the secretary. The secretary was actually very, very involved in reserve forces as well in her experience, and very familiar with Ellsworth as well as the installation facilities manager there about what's going on in Ellsworth. We're very close to what's called a record of decision for an operation area, an air operation area out there that extends in northwestern South Dakota and just a little bit of North Dakota and southeastern Montana, and really does portend a great future for Ellsworth, and especially with the projection of power and that authority that we need, and the training site will not only help our nation directly, but also our Air Guard that needs training space. And so it'll be premier airspace that soon we're awaiting the FAA approval along with the Department of the Air Force, and that's what the governor is meeting with them. In addition to that, this week the governor met with the head of the Fermi Lab, a totally different topic, but just as exciting because a number of us have been here since the beginning of the homestake, now the Sanford Underground Laboratory facility, to study the ability and the dark matter and the long-range neutrino or that type of research. And the one thing that the Department of Energy is very focused on, and the director of the lab is making sure that the world is coordinated and that we can go ahead and work with Fermi Lab as they essentially want to turn a beam to the mine and be able to do the neutrino research that way. And it really is on the cusp of very, very significant research. The president put in his budget more money this year for keeping the operation of the Sanford Underground Lab going. But on Sunday, the governor is going to be meeting with the Secretary of Energy, who also is a particle physicist, and so is very knowledgeable about what we're doing and just the future, and this will take it to the next level. And very, very exciting. So I wanted to give you those updates, and when he returns, we obviously will have a great deal of updates directly to brief us all on for the benefit of our state. Next, I wanted to turn and talk about our future. And the future from my legislative experience really revolves around two areas. One, structural things that we can do that really aren't what I would call media worthy or interesting. But those things that affect in the other bucket would be those in things that would eventually affect or currently affect our future, and that is the kids. I have to say, when I'm interviewed, what's the most profound piece of legislation I've ever worked on that has affected K through 12 education in my career as a legislator was the Opportunity Scholarship. The Opportunity Scholarship didn't directly financially help school districts, but it engaged a lot of parents, myself and my wife included, in working with our son in ascertaining what he might be interested in taking, whether or not he wanted to go on a technical education track, or if he needed to take other classes, starting in eighth grade of all things, to make sure that you didn't close any doors by selecting out of various courses. And one of the visions that the governor has is to continue to support that. And obviously, you know that Wednesday the House of Representatives passed the increase to that Opportunity Scholarship, which is huge. I know from my son's group, who is one of the first young people that had taken advantage of that. He's now a third-year medical student, but had got us focused when we were in eighth grade what classes that he might be interested in. And going up $1,500 from the $5,000 that's currently supported by the taxpayers is a pretty significant issue. And I have the opportunity, as a number of you know, to work with our youth up here, O'Hara's Pages, and they talk a great deal about that and the comparison and the incentive that that provides. In addition to that, of course, is last week the Build Dakota Scholarships, which really is going to be transformational, whether people are interested in going to the tech school for automotive trades or welding, some med lab techs, light LPNs, those type of things. I encourage anybody who doesn't know anything about that to look at our Department of Education website on this. Go ahead and Google, because not too many people are aware of it. And your advertising and covering it from the media has been very helpful. But even young people, as of yesterday, I was talking with a young man who's thinking about some ranching career, was unfamiliar with it. And so we directed it to him. He's actually a page in the House right now. So very, very happy about that. In addition to that would be, you know, student future planning. I think that we all owe it to our kids, if we're talking with them, whether in a formal or an informal setting, what their dreams are, not where they're going or what they're going to do, but what their dreams are, because that's how I normally phrase it. And I have a pretty unusual career path myself, but I started in a technical trade as a registered nurse. And that was only by encouragement of people who I was working with or people that I encountered. I certainly did have some people in school that were important to me, but really I fell into that career by virtue of starting to volunteer at a hospital and then people that I was with encouraging them. So the governor and I are big apostles of making sure that people have opportunities through not only career planning, if you will, through schools, and South Dakota My Life, we call it on our website, but also internships, opportunities to have that experience in South Dakota. And it's been shown when we have internships in South Dakota, people have that experience. We have many internship opportunities in the state, whether it's state government or business. And again, I think our son is probably a very good example of that. He's did a couple of internships in this state when he was in his undergrad that really assisted him in his focus and where he wanted to go. And I think we all have plenty of examples of that, or we've led through that. Finally, my third topic is the timing of the legislature and when we're in there. A number of you know that I was the Speaker of the House for a number of years, and now I preside over the Senate, and so am consistently focused on what our schedule is. And if you think of our calendar as sort of a school year, our first semester is fairly long, but it gets over next Wednesday in a time frame we call crossover. In other words, our exams are next Wednesday, no later than next Wednesday, to either pass a bill that originates in the House or the Senate or defeat it. And so it'll be a blizzard of activity. on Tuesday and Wednesday, since there's no session on Monday. And bills that pass out on Tuesday need to have hearing. Today, everyone is hunkered down on Fridays because there is no Monday committee, and there's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, just like classes. And so the committees that meet on these days are very busy sending bills out. And then right after that, we have a limited period of time to deal with the bills that, in our case, the House has sent over to the Senate and vice versa. One of the things that you know, and a number of you have covered and listened to, is as we come down to March, will be our projections financially where we're at. We always are dealing with two budgets. The one that we're currently in, our budget year ends June 30th, and our revenue numbers that we've received from Christmas have been somewhat soft. We've had to revise down where we're at, and so it's not like when we come in March for the current bill, the current year that we're in, we are not flush with cash. And so as we would be sitting around in our homes talking about budgets, we're pretty close to budget, if not down about 1%, about $1.5 million. Well, $1.5 million on 800 and some million may not seem that much, but the next months are relatively soft purchase months, like January. We'll get our January numbers here the first week of March, and we'll report those to you. We don't see, and yesterday was the meeting of what we call our Council of Economic Advisors. Those are individuals who are knowledgeable in the area of what's happening nationally, internationally in the markets and economies, and what then it convert that to what's happening in South Dakota. And it's, so it's a fascinating group of people volunteering their time to assist us in analyzing where we think we're going. And we're going to see a moderate growth for the next fiscal year. And so when we get to that point, it's sort of a trade-off. We're going to see pretty good tourism, we think, because of gas and people wanting to stay closer to home, but good gas prices. The flip side is the ag economy has some softness, and we've seen a diminishment in the purchase of equipment in terms of that percentage. And so as you match that up, we're probably putting in 3.5% to 4% growth in sales tax, and that's what we're working on. So with that, I just wanted to sensitize us to the fact that we're getting down to, and people will always say, how come you wait to do the budget at the last minute? Well, that's not true. It's not accurate, and it's an incomplete characterization, because there's a lot of analysis and requests going on. And so if you think about yourself sitting around the home, the kids are asking, we want this toy, we want this vehicle, we want to do these trips. And so you're really in the demand stage of people ask. And then we get together as a family and we look and go, but we think this is what's going to happen. We're going to get this kind of pay raise, but also our insurance is going to increase. Gas prices will go down. And so you come to essentially the end of completing your budget, and it's based on where we think we're having at the revenue. We don't seem to have a problem finding things to spend money on. And so we have a problem determining in a conservative fashion where we think our revenues are going to be. And I think that's just human nature. So thanks for listening to me. And now I'd like to listen to you. Questions?
Start with questions in the room. Is there any?
Excuse me. Mr. Lieutenant Governor, Mark Swartzel with the Dakota News Network. Can you hear me okay?
Go Navy.
Yes, sir. With regard to the Air Force, Secretary James is in Minot today, I believe, meeting with some top generals and brass and the people up there. When is that meeting going to take place again with the governor?
You know, I am not sure. He's booked up. More often than not, these meetings happen on the weekends.
Okay.
So okay. I'm That's thinking, right. You know, she's the Secretary of the Air Force. She has access to aircraft. So
Right.
Yeah. So I think she'll, I believe it's Saturday.
Okay, great. So you think that's, so it's probably not going to take place in South Dakota then. It'll be in Washington.
I'm sorry, yes. The governor is in Washington, D.C. He left yesterday, and so he has these side meetings, Mark. Yep.
Okay, great. That's what I wanted to know. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for the question.
Lieutenant Governor Tony Mangan at KCCR.
Hi, Tony.
How are you?
Excellent. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear from you, too, Lieutenant Governor. A quick question. Regarding the transportation funding bill, you know, there was some concern expressed by some opposition, or at least some that had some questions earlier in the week. Do you feel like it's coming along like it should at this time of the session, that kind of a big legislation?
We sure do. You know, the governor and I, as you've covered and everybody who's on the line has covered, have gone around the state talking with individuals and really aren't hearing great opposition. Is mostly trying to figure out the ratios of the amount of funds local versus state. And there is a very, very unique fact pattern here because almost everyone that we hear of understand that there's a problem that needs to be tackled. And so this will come down to the last day determining in a conference committee what those priorities should be and the funding from a local to a state ratio. Now, the governor's been very clear on that, and that is, without getting too deep into the weeds, that although there are a lot of local roads, the bulk of the traffic is on our state system, overwhelmingly, one. Number two, you know, just the large number of 18-wheelers, large vehicles, and the wear and tear that does on our state roads, we just have to stay ahead of it. And so he'll be doggedly determined to make sure that it doesn't erode what we need for our state highway improvement and maintenance.
And from a standpoint of taking a look at the amendments that you have seen so far and the other proposals and the melding of it, are there any deal breakers out there at this point?
You know, I wouldn't call them deal breakers because, you know, most of it's just part of the legislative process. You know, the governor, I guess I would say if the total package coming to the state and locals drop below $50 million, he would, there would be a dust up over that. But we're not feeling that. It's mostly between what Senate Bill 1, which was the summer committee's work, that was passed out of the Senate, and that which the governor's proposal, somewhere in the middle or some sort of ratios. So I don't think from the governor's perspective, outside of ensuring that we have enough for the state system going in the future, that it'd be deal breaker. The second one, though, that I'm prompted by your question, Tony, is that people have said, you know, the gas tax of 2 cents for every year with no stop is not acceptable. The governor has said if that's, you know, shorter than a 10-year period or a 15-year period, he will oppose that move. And so we'll be in that negotiations just because it'll put people as stewards. You know, it's a word that we have internalized as the way the governor and I are, is that we've got to make sure that this is in place for a long period of time to make sure that the cost of roads are kept up and that we are paying our fair share from the gas tax.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tony. Bob?
Mr. LT, this is Jerry, WNAX.
Hi, Jerry. How are things back home?
Happy Friday. They're going to play baseball at Riverside here at the top of the hour.
Basketball in Pier, too.
Yeah. No, this is baseball.
I know. I was talking basketball in Pier as well.
I know. So on the Blue Ribbon Task Force on Education, has the outlines been formed yet? How many people, you know, what walks of life, that type of thing, timelines? Have you, the administration, put that together yet?
No, Jerry. Thanks for the question. What we have done, though, is we've set up a system whereby people have asked to be considered to be put on, and we hopefully will have that ironed out before session is out in terms of those parameters. But no, we don't have any of that yet.
Anticipate holding, say, public meetings around the state and take input, that type of thing?
I sure do. I know the governor does as well. And it's very similar to the pattern that he's asked us to undertake in other areas such as corrections, juvenile justice, things like capital outlay and those type of things. Very open and posted, and the more the merrier to provide information. I mean, I say it a lot. The governor says it a little differently, that we might be smart individually, but collectively we're brilliant.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jerry. Enjoy the baseball. Bob Mercer.
Lieutenant Governor, you testified earlier this week on Senate Bill 191, which had to do with capital outlay certificates. And candidly, I don't understand what you hope to accomplish by the changes that are being made in that bill. Do you see some opportunities for school districts that they're not taking advantage of now?
I do. Thanks very much for the question, Bob. Bob's question relates to a concept in Senate Bill 191. A couple of years ago, when we took office, the governor asked, along with all of us, he gave us different areas of responsibility, and ostensibly they were based on some of our experiences. And one of my experiences has been in the tax-exempt financing world. In other words, with people going out and borrowing money for housing projects. I'm the chair of a housing commission, and hospitals, schools, those type of things. And so there's a mechanism that schools utilize under the law, and it's a very good mechanism, utilizing local taxpayer dollars called capital outlay dollars. And those monies are used for school improvements, school additions, improvements like heating and cooling, or an addition, which would be obvious. And what happens is then you can go ahead and pledge. In other words, just like getting a loan, you take money that you know you're going to get under the law and go ahead and get a loan from an organization, could be a bank or a bond issuer, you know, somebody like that, and get a few million dollars to put the addition onto your school or put the heating and cooling. And every school district can do this and has done that. We currently have about $350 to $360 million worth of these capital outlay indebtedness certificates. They're called capital outlay certificates. And what happens is school districts individually determine their need, work with their school boards and their business offices, and then they go and hire a financial advisor or somebody to work with them to place those in a bank, that is to get the money from the bank, or put them out into the market so somebody could invest in them because they're tax exempt. Long story short is that you have different levels of need, you have different levels of loans, but you have a lot of folks putting those out and then getting a much higher rate of interest versus what we could do if the state could be of some assistance. So you could have a school district like Newell that wants to put on a new school addition or build a school using these certificates, but their interest rate would be significantly higher because they're smaller than one that, say, Rapid City, based on their rating and their capabilities. And so that would be true of any of us if we were borrowing money. So the long story short is, I had seen in a couple of these circumstances where I knew that school districts could save money if they had one central place to go to. And that central place is what we call our South Dakota Health and Educational Facilities Authority. An authority is not a government entity. It's sort of we call it a body politic, which is a fancy term for a separately existing entity, but it's not the state of South Dakota. And schools used to do this up until about 15 years ago. They'd do quite a bit of this through the authority, and we learned that there were various reasons why they weren't using it. So we provide this discretionary mechanism whereby we're going to establish, if a legislature agrees, a system where these school districts could use the state's rating, that is our level of credit, and by doing that we'll have a program whereby they could borrow the money, get reduced underwriter fees, that is the cost of just even doing it, you know, like a bank origination fee if you go get a loan there. Secondly, the authority has negotiated rates with those folks and be able to at least analyze their financials so they could get a better rating, and then assist in placing those in banks or issuing them in the open market, which is what these authorities do. We do it in the Building Authority all the time, as you know, Bob, and so does the Health and Educational Facilities Authority. So they're experts. They don't charge a lot of money. Their motivation is to save taxpayer dollars and to also protect the bond issuer. And at the same time, those people who are owning these certificates or bonds. How does the program work? In a nutshell, what we're saying is if you pass this bill, if a school district wants to participate in it, we're going to have a program that says if for some reason you can't make your payment to the bank, and then what we'll do is step in and get the state aid and intercept it, like in football, intercept that payment, and the state would make that directly to the bank. So the bank or the bondholder then isn't looking at a Newell School District or a Rapid City or a Watertown. What they're looking at is the program, the South Dakota Health and Educational Facilities Authority Capital Outlay Program. And that will result. We've been meeting with Standard & Poor's and Moody's, who are rating agencies, and this is something that they've seen in a few other states, works very well, and would allow for a better interest rate and save quite a bit of money. And as you heard in testimony, a lot of the school districts and the organizations supported it. And again, it's not mandatory, but people who are on school boards then would say, hey, we really should evaluate and do a price comparison. So thank you for the question. Was that helpful?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks.
Jackie with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Going back to the economy, and you had said it looks like South Dakota is looking at moderate growth. How's that comparing, do you know, in the discussions with other states and the U.S. economy?
Thanks, Jackie, for the question. You know, we don't see high highs in South Dakota. We don't see low lows. And a lot of that is because of our economy diversification. What I will tell you is that other states will have greater growth because they've had larger unemployment. And our issue, as I opened up in this and that all of you have covered, is our workforce. Workforce, workforce, workforce. And the governor has been focused on it every time we meet with organizations. I met with three organizations yesterday, and this was the top issue. We don't have enough bodies. We could put this addition on. We could have more performance. We could take more contracts if we had the individuals. And so we're trying these multi-pronged approaches, whether it's, hey, everybody who's watching or listening, come back to South Dakota. Or if you know somebody, come to South Dakota. And we need to be our own best salesmen and women, and that's part of it. Dakota Roots, and we have various other programs. But that's really going to be our growth constraint. And so we'll be moderate growth. I think our economic advisors for the world and the nation are saying, you know, there's a lot of international volatility, there's all these things, but that depending on the agricultural economy, that our budget has, like I said, in sales tax, about 4% growth, Jackie, and that's not explosive by any stretch of the imagination. And we're going to get that narrowed down at the end, as you know, at the end, to try to figure out where we think we're going to be in revenue. And the trade-off is the oil prices. Are people, you know, people are listening and watching with lower gasoline prices. Are we taking that as really a, you know, a huge windfall in our budget? Are we saving that, paying off debt, or are we spending it? In this stage of the game, people are not spending it.
And to clarify, too, the big kind of issue with the workforce is we want to attract more businesses, right? But they're seeing we don't know if you guys have enough people that we can hire to run our business. Is that kind of the issue?
Right. And I think that, you know, when I've been in Aberdeen, we've been in smaller communities that actually I was meeting with healthcare folks. There are a number of, you cannot hire certified nursing assistants to take care of people in nursing homes. And so some nursing homes are not admitting any individuals. And it's a similar issue within our community service providers, the people who are taking care of individuals with developmental disabilities in group homes. And, of course, the wage issues. I mean, you can get some pretty good wages working without having to do that type of work. And so I consistently asked both, it was healthcare, manufacturing, it was business all this week. And this question came up and I said, if you could magically wave the wand and double their pay, you know, would you have the workers? And they go, it sort of helps. And I think that that's just, as a number of you have informed, you know, seen, I'm part of the problem. I was a nurse and I'm not in the nursing profession. And so as we look at people transitioning, and obviously I'm getting older, how do we get people to go into these type of trades, these other occupations? I think that you've heard and you've all covered that we couldn't mint enough people who have welding expertise right now for the demand. And so orders are being turned away. So that's why we're trying to figure out, really, I personally think it's transformative, the Build Dakota Scholarships, in trying to get people to think about those type of opportunities post-high school, and then also all the funding that the governor is focusing on career and technical education in the schools, and trying to get us to think of other things as kids get older. Thanks, Jackie.
Do we have any other questions on the line? Any other questions in the room?
Yeah, I have one. Governor, can you walk us through briefly how the insurance bills would work in terms of state government essentially self-insuring itself and also the liability coverage for the Stanford Laboratory at the Homestake Mine? There are three bills, and they're resting, in the House right now, and they'll come up next week. But what would that save state government? And then secondly, just technically, how do they work? How would these programs work? Do you go out and get some reinsurance or what?
Thanks for the question, Bob. What Bob's referring to is three bills that we've been working on for a good year and a half, if not 2 years, called captive insurance. A lot of times when people hear this, justifiably, their eyes glaze over, or they think, you know, you got a captive insurance in the Caymans or something, because that's really how a lot of this started. But it really is, simply put, if you think of insurance that you have on your house, that you have two types of insurance. One, if Michaels comes and slips and falls, or if there's some damage from a tornado. And so you've got to either have protection because of the slip and fall if somebody sues you and you need to pay them, and you also have to get the house built back if there's some sort of damage. Well, the state is no different. We have a lot of buildings in the public responsibility. The building that we're sitting here is the Capitol building. And it came to our attention early on. Again, it's an area that the governor asked that I work in with Jason Dilges. And it came clear to us, actually, we were sitting right here. I was right in this spot, and it was right after the flood. And I came back here, and we were meeting, and it was when we had an earthquake in Pierre. It was a loud pop. And I'd experienced earthquakes in my prior life, and nobody knew what it was. And I said, well, it's either a sonic boom or an earthquake. And it turned out to be an earthquake, which is not all that unusual. But when we did an assessment of the building, it led to a number of things. I mean, partially what was occurring was the fact that we were looking at replacing the beautiful stained glass. Well, it's amazing one of those pieces didn't crash. And we found out this building is self-insured, not uninsured, but self-insured. And what I mean by that is if we needed to replace something, we would have to go to our savings account. And we don't have a lot in savings, regardless of the political rhetoric. There's not $30 million to replace, you know, a few of these beautiful panels. So what we did is we started a research, and we have about $2.5 billion worth of property that's currently insured. And we have another two that is not. And what we decided was we needed to figure out ways not only to get that insured, but do it economically. And the same in the mine. The mine is actually a landlord, so if you go down there and slip and fall or they lose something in a tenant, there's a lot of confusion as to who would be liable. If you think of yourself as a tenant, who is responsible for burning down the house? And did you have insurance or did you not? Well, we've got so many different universities and people down there, it's very confusing. And then when we talk about the authorities, which is the third bucket, not to drone on too much, but if you ever sit on a board, you have what's called directors and officers insurance, and that's what they have. And it's really insurance that's never utilized, but you have to pay for it. And so there's a lot of ways to save money by essentially self-insuring. And so these bills are self-insuring those three risks, property and casualty, buildings and things being lost for the state, buildings, which include the universities, et cetera. The second would be all the authorities like housing and building and all of that, and the people, protecting the people who are serving on those boards. And then the big area there for science and tech would be the mine and that exposure. What it does is essentially creates a very large deductible. And so if you think about reducing your costs on your insurance, if you want to reduce your cost in your home, you say, well, can I get a $1,000 deductible for wind and hail? And sometimes you can get it, sometimes you can't. And then you're paying that out of your own money. How do you fund that $1,000? Well, you take a little money out of your check or your wife's check, and then you build it up. And that's exactly what it is. And then we're able to go and get insurance on top of that called reinsurance. And we won't initially save a whole lot of money, Bob. We're going to have a lot more flexibility and appropriateness and coverage in all those areas. But our pro formas show that we're going to have certain losses just to be conservative. And so if we don't have those losses, we'll have saved money. But we also have a $4.5 billion pool of assets that need to be covered. One, that now will be insured. Two, we will be able to go to the market and get some very good rates in comparison to what we can do in our house. And then three, we can be flexible and more friendly and logical with losses. My example is when we came in, about a year after we came in, there was a loss at Coyote Village in USD and a water pipe had blown up. And the kids lost their food and nobody knew actually, but what we did, and I authorized it, frankly, was just Craig Ombach, who's just incredible with our risk folks, insurance people working for us in the state, said we should just give each kid $25 because they're going to need to go eat. And I said, well, just do it. And our insurance company fought us for 3 months on doing the right thing. And now I don't even have to worry about them if this passes. You just do the right thing and not worry about whether or not you can get coverage. You still have to act as an insurance company, but you don't have to be ruthless. I mean, so thanks for asking the question. It's hard to do in a soundbite.
Well, yeah, just follow up for 1 second. How much of that would you set aside in a pool, say, for example, for your deductible?
For property and casualty, we're asking for an initial funding of $4 million. And that's really, we hired experts to analyze based on our losses. Our largest losses of all things, which wouldn't surprise us, are hail and smoke and some roofs, big ones. And we've all had to live through that. And so that wouldn't surprise us. And then we're also getting premium then from all the entities like the universities and ourselves. And so we essentially fund that. And then it's $2 million for that we're asking for appropriation for the authorities, and then it's $2.5 million for the science and tech, but that's coming out of the fund that Barrick made us put together there, the owner of the mine, out of the $10 million. So we have $10 million sitting there that's supposed to protect us and Barrick, and they've authorized $2.5 million to be used for this captive insurance approach. Thanks for asking it.
Any other questions? All right. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Have a nice
Everybody
weekend.
Have a good weekend. Thank you very much.